one thing we saw in like literally every single contract, the library function that invoked this program that didn't actually check that the account that was passed was the token program. If the smart contract didn't check that, then you could pass your own program that would just empty the treasury instead of the token program. We then complained to the foundation, and then they put an extra check in the library function to check that program is actually the SPL token program.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH, exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV and intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%. GM, GM, everyone. My name's Tagachi, the host of Scraping Bits. And today, I have Nico from Neodyne. How's it going?
Yo, what's up?
Not much. I'm just chilling, man. I'm excited to talk to you, a fellow automator in the cyberspace. Just for the people that aren't familiar with you, who are you and what do you do?
So my name is Nico. I'm an auditor and co-founder at Neodyne. We've been doing primarily audits on Solana for the last, I think, almost 3 years now. We found a bunch of bugs in various blockchains, in Solana, in, I think, Near, in the Aptos and Sui, the move-based blockchains. So like in the core code itself, I've been interested in cybersecurity for like how long now? I think like 7 years now is like how long I've been playing CTFs, capture the flag competitions.
So man, tell me, how did you get into all this? Before you got into the cyber world and into Neodyne, what were you doing before then? And how did your kind of career progress into where you are now?
Yeah, so basically back in school, I did like a bunch of just various computer science competitions. One of them was like a capture the flag competition, essentially a hacker competition, which was back then kind of like a German national competition, I guess. I ended up winning that year. And we have this CTF team, which is called Alles, which we essentially recruit our members like from this competition, from like people that do well. Pretty much everyone is like from either like from Germany or like from Switzerland or Austria.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I got into CTFs. So I kind of played CTFs for like my whole studies of back when I was in college for computer science, just like while studying. At some point, we were pretty good. We got like invited to a bunch of international competitions. We were, I think, the sixth place team in the world at some point.
Oh, nice. In the world.
Yeah, right. Then like a team of mine, Leo, some people might know him. He used to work at Jump. He kind of was like in crypto before all of us. And he tipped us off to go look at Solana because they had, even like back then, pretty large bug bounties. This was like in late 2020, I think, early 2021. So back when Solana was like still at $1. And yeah, that's kind of how we got into crypto. We found a bunch of bugs. We got a bunch of bounties and then decided to found Neodyne, the success that we had with auditing.
Yeah. Well, Neodyne is more, I think at that time it was manual, but now you've kind of got into automation of it with RiverGuard, right?
Yeah, so our audits are still pretty much entirely manual, but I have like pretty strong opinions on auditing. Automating auditing is essentially as hard as automating the programming of the actual smart contracts.
Yeah.
But we have RiverGuard, which is essentially, it takes all on-chain transactions and it just tries to modify them in like smart ways. And if the transaction still succeeds, then that might indicate some sort of vulnerability being present in the smart contract.
Yeah, no, I have very strong opinions on automation as well, especially when it comes to cyber, which is very, I guess, contrarian. And even if you go deeper into it, where you get into like fuzzing communities and mention AI, they just completely don't want to hear it. But it's the same with manual auditors. They don't want to hear automation at all, which is like fair enough because it like jeopardizes their, I guess, careers, right? It's inevitable if we think about it. Man, like, so with RiverGuard, how did you get into building this? What was kind of the process? Did you build it from scratch or did you hitchhike off something like AFL? What does the architecture look like? And what was that kind of journey from nothing to prod?
Yeah, no, so we pretty much built it from scratch, obviously like depending on stuff like Kafka and things like that. But it's kind of like a pretty novel thing, I think. I don't think something like that exists anywhere where you like actually just...
Yeah, not on Solana at least.
Yeah, because like Solana just has like so many transactions happening. We have literal gigabytes of data per second that we have to process.
Mm.
Yeah, essentially, we just modified the validator to give us like all the information that we need to perfectly replay all transactions. We then push that into like a Kafka, and then that gets like distributed to workers that then essentially execute the, internally we call them fuzz cases. It's not really fuzzing, but like then execute like test cases, I think is a better word.
Okay, interesting. So why isn't it fuzzing then? You're saying it's like automated unit tests.
Yeah, I mean like it's under like a very broad definition of fuzzing. You could say it's fuzzing, but I don't think it's a very useful way of talking about it, because fuzzing is like very particular the way you go about it. Usually it assumes some form of prior knowledge about the target, because like you then set up your fuzzing harness and you have to have some kind of like corpus for fuzzing that you base your fuzzing search on.
If it is like a black box fuzzer, then it could learn, well, it could just experiment with like random inputs from 0 to UN256.
Yeah, no, for sure. But like the issue is that in this case, like in fuzzing, you usually have like a target you want to hit. So for example, a seg fault or whatever. And on Solana, it's a bit more difficult because you can't just say, okay, seg fault, we've got like a bug because they're like seg faults are not interesting and they don't really exist in Rust. It's like violations of very specific invariances. Like for example, the contract doesn't properly verify some input, like results in some output that we want. And that kind of process is like usually the hardest part of fuzzing, like actually defining the goal of the fuzzing, I guess. So like RiverGuard, we essentially just have like a bunch of targets, and the way you can reach those targets is essentially very simple. For example, I don't know how familiar you are with like how Solana invocations work, like Solana transactions work.
Just give a TLDR.
Yeah, so if you have like a Solana transaction and you call some smart contract, you essentially... like all the data is stored in accounts. And those accounts can, for example, be owned by the program. That means the program can modify the data in the accounts. And the way this usually works in Solana is that the smart contract then verifies the owner. So it verifies that itself is the owner of the account. And that means it can trust the data in the account. And if this check is missing, for example, then you could forge state. And that usually ends like results in loss of funds. So one of the fuzz cases, for example, is we just change the owner of one of the accounts in the transaction alongside the public key in case they like have a hard-coded check for the public key, and then see whether the transaction still succeeds. And if it still succeeds, then that's like a good indication that they missed a check there.
Yeah. Like access control, basically.
Yeah, exactly. That's like something where like fuzzing, where you just like randomly permutate stuff, like wouldn't help at all. And if you try to find stuff like this, just like by randomly doing stuff, it probably wouldn't work. Like fuzzing, like a bunch of the work in fuzzing is just trying to get the fuzzer to actually find the stuff you want to find. That's like the non-trivial part. And if you don't have any prior knowledge of the target, that's basically impossible.
Mm. Yeah, fuzzing... is like I've seen people do all of like the signals, basically, so like access control, etc. But I feel like you can just make it one goal. Like when we think about hacks, it's always extract money. So there's your goal. How do I get to this point? And it could become, you can think of it like there's four different pillars, and I always talk about this, but you know, there's context specific, you have functions, call data, and multiple, I guess, protocols with these functions, and you can order them in different ways spatially, but then you need to put them in a specific sequence eventually. And it depends like how much processing you have at the end of the day, because majority of like these hacks that are multi-millions of dollars is usually a combination of protocol A, B, and C in functions X, Y, Z in a specific context. It's because like a hack can occur during that sequence in a specific context where, let's say, like state, like slot A is 100, but in slot A equal a million, there's no exploit. So you can build something that does that. You kind of find everything. That's a hard thing.
Yeah, right. Like if you have like unlimited compute, obviously like you can find every sequence of transaction that will yield in you getting money. But that's like the hard part of fuzzing, to actually get the fuzzer to find the stuff without a lot of compute, because like you can't search the entire search space.
Yeah,
it's too large.
Yeah, it's way too big. And this is why I actually got into AIs. When I was building my fuzzer, at least, I was building the mutator. I was just about to finish. And I realized, you know, if I did, like, let's say, you know, multi-millions of iterations on, like, all these different protocols, and it's not learning after it, or, you know, finding common things that, like, okay, let's say if I'm hitting a lending protocol, if someone does a swap before it or after in the function, is there some kind of like order that might be like a flag? And although it might not be specifically in that order every single time, because every function is different, it could pick up on that. That'd be really hard to add to every single function manually. It's just like infeasible. And so I think actually AI is the next frontier in cyber. And matter of fact, everything. Just because it can like do this stuff automatically, and there's no, I guess, time restraint relative to humans doing it, like implementing everything yourself. But it depends how ambitious you are and how, what, you know, obviously your goals. For example, like Neodyme. Neodyme's like Riverside. You guys have almost done, how many digits is that? 10 digits of like fuzz transactions?
Oh, I don't think it's 10. Actually, I don't, probably not 10, but like a lot.
It's getting there. It's like 50 million off.
So we've didn't fuzz like every single transaction since like the beginning of Solana, because like you can't really replay old transactions that easily, because you'd have to essentially run old versions of the validator software. We kind of we started about running the code on all transactions, I think about half a year ago, a bit more maybe. It's not like billions, I think, but it's a lot, certainly.
It's almost 1 billion.
All right, we have like stats on our side, don't we?
Yeah, that's
all right. That's the one. All right, yeah. No, it's actually awesome.
Yeah, he's almost hit 1 billion fuzz transactions.
Yeah, no, that's right.
If you like apply AI to this, you could see it wouldn't take as long as like 10 milliseconds for each one. It might like identify really quickly and be like, oh, I can combine this with this. And I know this because it's happened so many times, or it's just a higher probability of, you know, transaction B following after this kind of, I guess, transaction or function, like interaction. But yeah, the more I got into it, it really made sense. Like that's this next frontier, and especially if it's able to adapt, which is why I kind of got into mutation-based AI, because I love mutation-based fuzzing. And I mean, if you can apply that in like some kind of algorithm where you can, it's optimizing itself on the fly, then it kind of solves everything, is basically my conclusion that I came to.
You know, like the idea we had with RiverGuard, so like I guess like one of like the foundational ideas was we thought about like fuzzing Solana for like years now. I'm still convinced that it's not really feasible right now, just because the search space is just like way too big. It's feasible to fuzz like if you have a contract in front of you and like you write your own harness and you like you know what kind of goals you want to hit, then it's feasible. But like if you just have like some contract deployed somewhere, you don't know what it does. I think right now it's just not feasible yet with like compute and like the tech, I guess, of how fuzzers work right now. Like they're not that magic. They're like pretty good, but like they still need a lot of manual work to properly work like on most targets. So like the idea we had with like RiverGuard was essentially there are like all these transactions happening on chain at any time. Why don't we like use them as fuzzing corpus, I guess? And that's like how we got the idea of just like taking all transactions that happen and then mutating them in like smart ways. So like the search space is like small.
Yeah. So it's more like you're doing, I guess, like pattern matching.
Yeah, right. That's kind of essentially what we do. We have transactions. We know, for example, these transactions, they have like they do token transfers. So we can apply like these rules to that. And then if they still succeed, then probably there's something going on.
Right. Have you ever thought of doing it like dynamically where it's not just a hard-coded pattern? As in like when you talk about transfers, this is something I was doing for my fuzzer, is if you see like a transfer, you just do like taint analysis on it and all the other dependencies that I guess depend on this transfer after it. Like what is impacted from this transfer both before it and after it? And can you change anything within this kind of realm? Or this kind of space, because now you filtered it out by, okay, this is an important thing where you're transferring tokens. What depends on it before and after? Can I interact these things to manipulate something else later down the line? And to the point where you're kind of spatially thinking of these different functions and pieces of code, I call them vital pieces, where, you know, it's like a transfer, which is a call, or maybe a static call, and something depends on that static call. A perfect example, actually, is I was reading the Pickle Finance exploit, and they had this part where you could deploy a custom ERC-20 token and the dot balance of could return anything, and that's put into the delegate call. So if you if you actually change the return value in the custom ELC20 to something like an address, it's going to call that address rather than an actual, you know, value. And like this kind of stuff was really interesting. And I think you could crack it if you do that kind of taint analysis, but then you have to match it to something where, okay, if I've got, you know, 30,000 contracts that exist on Ethereum or Solana, how can I actually determine which one can be like combined with this now vulnerable function right here? Because, you know, you can do arbitrary inputs in anything. It just depends, you know, what is that dependency? What does that taint analysis look like? But that's just what I notice, at least. And you can kind of silo these functions that are isolated and then just mix and match them in different orders. So then you don't even have a giant search space anymore. You just have, you know, X amount of functions instead of, well, you have X amount of functions, but then how can you combine them in ways that they relate? And usually that can come down to like swaps, lending, like categorization of them. And then you have, you know, common patterns within that. Maybe it's a custom code base, but there still are like identifiable parts of it that you can deconstruct and move around in different ways. But yeah, have you ever thought about doing that kind of stuff?
Yeah, no, I guess the issue is primarily probably that there is like no such thing as like just partially stealing money. Like in regular fuzzing, like the way the guided fuzzing usually works, like the smart fuzzing, like you can look at the code paths and then if you like hit a new code path, then you know, okay, you found something new. And you can kind of see like how close you get to like your target, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's a very difficult thing to do with like stealing money on chain.
Mm.
Because sure, like you can find new code paths in the smart contracts, but like there's probably 10 to the 100 code paths that do nothing. And then like 5 that steal money. And like, how do you identify that you're actually getting closer to stealing money is like a very difficult thing, I think.
Yeah, I think you've got to somehow create the relationship of between functions is, okay, does this update a storage slot that's critical? In what way can I update it within this function if I can't manipulate it freely or if it's very restricted when you're calling it? For example, it only updates +1 instead of, you know, the value you put in yourself. Maybe that you just can filter that out immediately. You kind of narrow down all the search space significantly. At least that's what I was doing and it kind of worked. But I guess with the current setup you have now, the hard-coded pattern matcher, how do you attempt to reduce the amount of false positives? Because it's always like the main thing.
Yeah, no, so I think right now our false positive rate is about 50%, like from what we manually triaged.
Okay.
So it's not terrible, it's not great. But like for all of those fuzz cases, it depends on the actual fuzz case. Some of them you can't really do much. You just like either you have like some of them actually every finding is like a bug. For example, there's one fuzz case where we find sinks and sources of token transfers in a transaction. And then we just replace the sink without changing anything else and see if the transaction still succeeds. This is pretty much, so essentially just like, for example, a transaction that like someone withdraws funds from a lending protocol. We just go in, replace their wallet with ours and see if we still get the funds. And if that's the case, then we could have stolen their money. And this is pretty much always like an actual loss of funds bug. Besides, there's like a couple of false positives with fees where some smart contracts have like swaps, for example, where they give the front end a swap fee. And those keys you can usually replace without any issue. Those are false positives, but the rest are all actual bugs. For other like, fast cases, you can do some smart things. For example, I think of an example. All right. For example, I earlier talked about the fast case where we changed the owner of program accounts. We also try to set all bytes to zero, to random data. And if it then fails, that means it actually uses the data. If it still succeeds, then it probably doesn't actually use the data of the account and it's a false positive. That still doesn't filter out everything because a bunch of smart contracts like deserialize accounts and then never use the data from those. And you can probably do it even better by like doing actual taint analysis where you like see whether they read the data. But that's something that's a lot of effort and probably not worth it.
Yeah, especially for Rust, it would be much harder.
Yeah.
There's way more bytecode. than if you were just doing like a Solidity contract, for example.
Yeah, no, for sure.
And the dependency graph gets really, really big.
Yeah, it's like impossible to reverse engineer the Rust contracts. It's actually insane.
Yeah, one thing I was like thinking about is whether I should build an optimizer to make my reverse engineering easier. So it's like you optimize these Solidity compiler, like these Solidity compiled code, and then to the point where it's like bare bones assembly, and then you reverse engineer that. But I never got to that point of like optimizing Solidity and sort of bare bones. I feel like it would be a fun little hacker project.
You know, I think that's like a pretty standard way to reverse engineer novel architectures and CTFs is to compile them with LLVM, then use that output from LLVM, like the optimized output to and reverse engineer. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, depends on the challenge.
Yeah, I think also maybe like you optimize so well that you actually get rid of a bug.
Yeah, especially like when you try to find seg faults, because seg faults are always undefined behavior. It might just optimize the bug away.
Oh yeah, I understand. That's also like a big thing. It's like, oh, if I actually optimize this, what if I get rid of the bug and I don't know that? And I say it's fine, but secretly it's not.
I think with like EVM bytecode, it should be fine because there's like no undefined behavior in EVM bytecode, right?
Yeah, of course. But let's say someone did like custom assembly and you're writing like an optimizer for assembly as well, and it just like overwrites their assembly, which has the bug. I guess you would have to test the functionality in each path that you optimize for.
You know, I think like if you have an optimizer that's like correct and like the result does the same thing as the input, then it's probably fine. But like, of course, it's difficult to know whether the optimizer is actually correct on all input.
Oh yeah, 100%. Well, I mean, having done this, what have you found any bugs that have been like kind of war stories? You're like, oh my god, we've actually found something that would have been very detrimental to Solana. At least in terms of their ecosystem.
Like with RiverGuard specifically?
Yeah, like RiverGuard and also just doing manual audits as well.
Starting with like RiverGuard, I think we published a blog post yesterday. It's on blog.new.no for anyone who wants to check out our blog. So I guess I can talk about that bug because it's public. So this was before we made RiverGuard public, and we just essentially triaged a bunch of findings ourselves. So the finding we got for this contract was actually, well, let me just try to remember. Yeah, right. The finding we got for this bug was what we call a self-transfer, which essentially means, so imagine you deposit funds into like some protocol, but instead of sending it to the treasury, you send it to yourself, but the protocol still thinks you deposited the money. You like get, I don't know, liquidity tokens or something still. That's like the kind of finding we got for this. And this is also very often a bug.
Is that like a Solana-based bug?
Yeah, I think it's, I don't think there's like an EVM equivalent. So like how it's like this in the way this works in Solana is you usually have like some account that's like the treasury of a protocol. For example, like for like if you have just a swap, you have two accounts that hold the liquidity for each token. And if you then want to deposit liquidity into the swap, you would call the contract. And as like one of the arguments, essentially, you pass the treasury. And the contract is then supposed to verify that it actually got the right account as the treasury account. And if that is not done, then you can then the contract will transfer the funds from you to yourself instead of from you to the treasury.
Are there any other like Solana specific bugs? I guess kind of like reentrancy in Ethereum, read only reentrancy, all that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, there's a bunch. So Solana has like a lot of foot guns. It used to be like way worse back in the day. A bunch of stuff got better.
You know why I don't think there's so many Solana like hackers? It's because you can't grab like the bytecode.
Yeah, for sure. Also, most stuff is closed source, which makes it a lot harder.
Oh yeah, it has Solana would be so wrecked.
It for sure has its negatives, but it also has like some positives.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I'm like, oh, I can't imagine the amount of bugs in Solana just because I can't grab the bytecode. That's the only reason.
Yeah, no, like back in the day, it was like really bad. Like I said, we started in like early 2021. Back then, literally only DeFi on Solana was Serum, which was like an order book, an on-chain order book essentially.
Right.
Which is now called Open because it was coded funded by Alameda, I think.
Oh God.
Then like the first couple of protocols came on chain. First couple of DeFi protocols, I think like Radium was one of the early ones. Solent was, I think, one of the early ones. They essentially just adapted code by the Solana Foundation itself. And back then, no one really knew how to like write secure Solana code. It got a lot better with Anchor, which is like a framework that helps in creating Solana programs. But like back then, it was very rough. For example, one thing we saw in like literally every single contract we looked at. So I don't know if this is also a bug on Ethereum. When you, for example, like there's in Solana, there's like a program you have to call to transfer tokens, the SBL token program, which you have to call for every token transfer. And like the library function that invoked this program didn't actually check that the account that was passed was the token program. So if the smart contract didn't check that, then you could pass your own program that would just empty the treasury instead of the token program. And that was like pretty much part of every single contract that we looked at. We then complained to the foundation, and then they put in like an extra check in the library function to check that program's actually the SPL token program.
Oh my God. Interesting. I mean, when you've been doing all this, and especially with Riverside, did you ever think about, I guess, AI, especially how it's heating up now? AGI is just being talked about all the time, and ChatGPT, people are going crazy about it. Depends also what kind of community you're in, but I mean Elon Musk just like sued Sam based off it. And also I think it's very interesting in terms of cyber. If it can build some kind of intuition, it saves so much time on the search space exploration kind of problem. If there's options, how do you dwindle it down to get to a point where there's only N options left?
Yeah, I don't actually know how well LLMs would work specifically for fuzzing or similar things.
There is one guy I know, and he does like LLM assisted fuzzing. So it's like it kind of directs the fuzzer by prompting it, I think.
Yeah, I'd probably have to. I'm sure there's probably papers on this, but I haven't really like read into any of those. I imagine it's probably too slow because like fuzzing, if you do like fuzzing really well, you have like a bunch of executions per second. It's like way more data than any LLM can handle. But maybe there's like a way to make it help guide the fuzzer. I'm not sure. Like I'm still like on the fence with how useful LLMs are right now. Like they still seem like very stupid. Oftentimes, like unreasonably stupid, and just like very good on stuff that you could like find with a Google search, stuff that's like part of the training data, I guess, but like not very good at finding novel things.
LLMs are quite useful for like, I guess, reconnaissance. So explain what this function is doing, maybe.
Yeah, like for reverse engineering, I think it's sometimes, and like reverse engineering challenges, like sometimes it works like really well. Sometimes it just hallucinates everything.
Yeah, of course.
I still like haven't figured out when it works well. It's probably when there's similar challenges on the internet, I guess, because like it's already seen how to interpret what it sees. As soon as it has like transfer, like has to transfer reasoning, it starts hallucinating.
Oh yeah, 100%. I imagine like in the future, I guess when like these AI architectures get a bit more advanced, like, let's say like a swarm technology with its multi agents, which is kind of what GPT is trying to do now. Like OpenAI, sorry. And I imagine, like, I think it's quite easy to make some kind of cyber virus, like some virus that is, like, it adapts automatically. And let's say you give it the goal of just reproduction into, like, every hardware system. I assume, like, and if it had this point of being able to mutate and, like, adapt, it would just, you know, discover vulnerabilities and create, like, an exploit module for that specific piece of code. Or if it cannot, it would evolve to, I guess, social engineer and actually, I guess, take on that way. That's kind of what I see the future as, but obviously it's like, oh, how do you make that architecture?
Like the way I think about it is in terms of LLMs, I think finding vulnerabilities is at least as hard as writing code that is secure. So, like, if we were, like, ever at, like, some point where you could just tell the LLM, please find a bug in Linux, like, please find an ODE and, like, replicate yourself across all Linux computers. At least my hope is that you could also just ask the LLM to fix all bugs in Linux and then you wouldn't have the issue at all.
It depends if it goes rogue or not as well, though. It's like, oh, can you actually change it to the point where it stops creating bugs? Or is it just by itself doing its thing?
Yeah, I think this is kind of like the fear some people have, like, with general AI.
Yeah, the doomers.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure, like, I really buy it, because, like, if we, like, ever get to that point, like, we just have no idea how that would even look. Like, I mean, like, with LLMs, like, the way we prompt them, like, I don't think there's, like, a risk of them, like, going rogue. It'd be kind of weird.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, like, all the doomers are thinking about that, but I don't know. Like, it's so hard to predict the future as well. But I do think AI is going to play a giant role in everything.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like, I think it's going to...
We saw Elon doing the Neuralink on a human, and it worked. Like, the first test subject. I just imagine, like, walking past a human with one of those Neuralinks with a, you know, RFID scanner. But instead of, like, stealing a credit card, it's, like, hacking their brain.
Yeah, honestly, like, I take everything that Elon says with, like, a huge grain of salt, because, like, he's... just talking BS more often than not. But I think, like, AI, like, obviously, like, right now it's not, like, I think it's useful for, like, a bunch of things. Like, for example, Copilot has been really nice since, like, a couple of years now, and I think it's only getting better. I've heard someone talk about this recently. Like, the way to think about this is, like, similar to how, like, the PC kind of revolutionized how we do work.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, it's just going to help make everyone more productive is like the way I think it's going to go down.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. Like, it just kind of, I mean, I use AI instead of Google now. So it just, like, increases productivity. But what do you think is missing right now in, like, the crypto ecosystem for cyber? And where do you kind of see it going? Well, you can say more specifically on Solana, since you have experience on that.
Interesting, what's missing. I think, like, on Solana specifically, I think, like, the biggest thing is probably, like, good frameworks for testing, for fuzzing, for creating programs. Like, Anchor was still, like, a huge step, but it's still not perfect. You know, we don't have something like that. We don't really have, like, Anchor has, like, an integrated testing framework, but, like, it's nice for what most devs need. Like, it's just a bit of, like, integration testing, but a few testing. Like, it does its job, but just, like, the possibility of, like, creating, like, big test suits and creating fuzzing harnesses for your smart contract and stuff like that is still a lot of manual work.
Can you do fork testing?
Sorry, fork testing?
Yeah, like, you fork the mainnet, basically, and you can test against that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, local net validators. That's also, like, part of Anchor, I think.
Okay, interesting. What do you think security overall is going to become, especially with AI coming into play? Me, personally, I think there's going to be a whole new field of AI security. Securing AI, but also, you know, red teaming it to the point where you extract, like, critical data from these things that have been trained on, for example, hospital data.
I know, for sure. I think that's, like, been a thing for years now. I think it was in 20, well, let me think, I think I turned 21 that year, so that would have been 2019 at DEF CON. In the DEF CON CTF, we were in the finals that year, and there was a challenge. So, like, there was way before LLMs existed, or, like, before LLMs, like, actually worked well. Essentially, you had to extract faces out of neural network that recognized faces, was kind of the challenge, I guess.
I know some people, the only thing I really know now is that I've seen a few people do, like, reverse prompt engineering of, like, trying to find what was given to the LLM as a prompt. For example, I think X's AI Grok was given, like, hitchhike. Oh, you talk like you're in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I think. And, like, always witty, but sarcastic at the same time. You know, that kind of stuff. But I've never seen it to the point where it's, like, reverse engineering vital data of, like, oh, this is the address of XYZ. This is what they do.
I mean, like, the LLM itself is, like, it's just a huge, I don't know how large they actually are, but I'm sure they're, like, terabytes of data. Like, this kind of thing works, like, essentially, like, reconstructing neural networks. It's, like, something that, it, like, works and has been, like, done for years. It takes quite a bit of queries, and it's pretty difficult if you can execute a bunch of queries directly. Yeah, it's probably difficult to do, like, the large LLMs that you can access online.
Oh, yeah. Have you done any node auditing or, like, validator auditing?
Yeah, for sure. The way we started was essentially finding bugs in Solana itself, like, in the validator.
Between, like, smart contract auditing versus like validated auditing. I mean, it's a big difference in terms of like code base and complexity. Is anything transferable though?
No, I mean, like in cybersecurity in general, like most things, if you're like a good auditor, you're gonna don't have like much issues looking at just different things. Like that's like the way we hire is we usually hire CTF players that we know, because that's like if someone's good at CTFs, you know they're gonna adapt to different challenges super fast. And I think like with validator specifically, like the code base is very large.
Yeah.
It's like one thing, it's if you don't know how to approach large code bases, it might be like very daunting. If you just open like the GitHub and just like click through things, you have like no idea where to start. That's like something that CTFs really help, because you're kind of just used to, I don't know, getting some code base and then just trying to find a bug as fast as possible.
Oh yeah. This company, Asymmetric Research, they recently found like a vulnerability in the Polygon L2, I think, nodes or validators. It must have been validators. It was from Felix.
No, right, the Trump security shoot off, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think that is really critical, and people don't really take too much notice about it versus like a smart contract. But
yeah, no, for sure. I think a bunch of people actually underestimate like the risk that blockchains possess in general, and especially smart contracts. No one thinks about the risk of just losing everything because a smart contract might be hacked. This is probably like a very unpopular opinion. Like everyone's trying to push liquid staking. I would never put my money into liquid staking. Like it just seems such an unnecessary risk for like what, like 2% yield a year.
It's just, you know, you're putting all that Ethereum into a single entity, and yeah, I don't do it either. Like imagine there's just one vulnerability in it, it's all gone forever.
Yeah, no, like it's scary. And it's not even like you get like, I don't know, like 50% yield, you get like 2%, which is like completely negligible. You could buy treasuries and get more.
Oh yeah, just go shitcoin instead. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, no, for sure. So,
and I think like validator auditing is, I think, way harder for like developers to be correct, because there's so much complexity and it's all interacting with each other.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like you need experience to do that. I think like Felix used to work for Google Project Zero.
Yep.
So like he for sure knows his way around complex code bases. Let's say I think there's a reason why a bunch of successful auditors in crypto in general are like CTF players. There's OSEC on Solana. It was founded by Robert Chen, which used to play for, or still plays for Dice Gang, which is like an American team. Mm. Then Celic was founded by Steven, I forgot his last name. I think he was playing with Perfect Blue, if I'm not mistaken, also like one of the top teams. And I think it's like, because it's also like why we, like back when, 3 years ago, when we first looked at the validator, I think it took me like 2 weeks to find my first bug. But like once I found my first bug, I found like four in a row.
Oh, wow. But still 2 weeks to find a validator bug is pretty crazy.
Yeah, like right nowadays, it's even faster. Like I think 1.5 years ago when there was like this wave of new L1s.
Oh, yeah.
At the start of like the bear market, I think. With some of them, it took us literally 3 hours from, I think I'll take a look at X, to, hey, I found a bug in X.
Oh my God. That's kind of crazy. Are there bug bounties for like validators as well?
Yeah, they're the ones that are like the most profitable. I think Solana pays 400 grand for the denial of service and 2 million for loss of funds right now. That's like also the reason I get asked a lot why like audits are so expensive.
Yeah.
It's not just that we can ask for the money. It's primarily just if you have like an auditor that can make, that is like good, they can make way more money looking for bug bounties in crypto. Like if you have like an auditor that takes 2 grand for a week of work, like a good auditor could make like 100 times that amount looking for bug bounties in the same time.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So how long were you doing bug bounty for as well? Like before you started NeoDime, and do you think it's like changed? Because I feel like bug bounty is like time constrained. Actually, some of them are, unless you want to do evergreen ones that are always there until you find something. But with auditing in the company, that's like time restricted as well, though. So let's say they give you like X amount of time with a company, but with bug bounties, you have unlimited time until something's found. What is your methodology for finding like AS validator bugs?
I think with NeoDime, it's just because we're kind of a small company, I guess. I think we have like 20 people now, or a bit more, but most of our employees actually don't work in crypto. We have like a pretty big part of the company now that does like regular security.
Yeah.
I think we have, what, 7-8 people that work on crypto. And we mostly just like, if we're motivated to look at blockchains, we're going to like spend 1 or 2 months, 1 or 2 months to look at different blockchains. Or we might just decide that we are more motivated to do audits now. And then that's what we're doing. So we're fortunate enough to like have the choice to essentially like do whatever we want right now. So
when you're doing an audit for like, let's say a validator, what is your kind of methodology for getting into it and trying to find something?
Oh, there's like, I don't think I have a fixed methodology. It really depends on the target. It's like just something you learn by just looking at a bunch of different things. Like again, like CTFs are just hugely helpful for that.
Is there any like specific file you go into first though? Or is it just like, you just jump into eeny, meeny, miny, mo?
So like if you want to find denial of service things, like networking is usually the first thing I look at to check whether you can do funny things. Also, like obviously the runtime is like the most sensitive part of any blockchain. Yeah, things like that.
Interesting. Runtime. Do you build any tools to like set up fuzzing for this stuff?
It does, like with most things. It's a bunch of manual work though, like fuzzing usually is. For example, one of the bugs like in the early days that I found was like a very stupid kind of fuzzer. So in Solana, there's like this thing called gossip, which is just like all nodes talking to each other. And I essentially just set up like a small networking script that would just send random gossip packages to see whether it would do anything. And that found like a bug after a couple of minutes, for example. That's like the low-hanging fruits. I don't think they exist anymore, at least I hope. But obviously fuzzing is like useful to find bugs in any large code base. It's like what you do if you want to find bugs in Linux. It's what you do if you want to find bugs in Chrome.
I wonder if you can set up like an automatic, I guess, like a suite, a program to set up fuzzing suites for all different files. I feel like that would be really beneficial.
Yeah, maybe if like AI gets better, maybe I can do it at some point. But I think right now it still takes a lot of like manual.
Yeah. Just setting up the EVM one, it was quite easy because like the EVM can be condensed and you can write your own one very quickly for like a validator, which is like dozens of files.
Like you have to write like multiple harnesses for each thing you want to fuzz.
Yeah, exactly. It becomes very difficult, I feel like. Interesting. I can't imagine like a validator like obfuscating their code either.
Yeah, no, that's fortunately most validators are open source, so that's not the issue.
I kind of want to get into validator auditing now, just a little bit. But man, I'm super excited to see what comes of NeoDime in the future, and I really want to see you do dynamic fuzzing as well.
Yeah, maybe someday when we have like a lot of free time. It seems like a lot of effort, and it's not clear to me that it actually works.
Yeah, it depends on like your initial methodology, but I think honestly the way forward is using AI, creating your own architecture for it, to I guess guide fuzzing and learn from these things.
Yeah, no, for sure. If you're gonna fuzz smart contracts, you're gonna use guided fuzzing. Everything else doesn't make sense.
Yeah, exactly. But man, Nico, I really appreciate you coming on and speaking to me today. And I'm sure a lot of other people are going to really appreciate this and enjoy listening. So thank you so much for coming on. I'm sure we're going to talk again soon in the future.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me, for sure.
Of course. And for anyone wanting an order on Solana or any L1s or L2s, validators, just hit up NeoDime.
Right. I think I'll just plug our website. It's neodime.io. We have like a blog post that I think is pretty interesting. We've actually written about a couple of the loss of funds bugs we found in the Solana validator. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff, check it out.
Yeah, if you want your money lost, hit up this guy. Thank you once again. I'll talk to you soon.